Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Mark Settle to the broadcast. Mark is the Chief Information Officer of Okta, a leading provider of identity and device management solutions for various cloud and mobile enterprises. As CIO, Mark leads Okta's global enterprise IT strategy and operations and collaborates closely with the executive leadership team to align strategic technology initiatives with broader business goals. Mark is also the author of Truth from the Trenches, a practical guide to the art of IT management, the insights from which we discuss in depth in this interview. The book represents a synopsis of the practices he's used as a CIO many times over at companies like IHS, BMC Software, Oxy, Arrow Electronics, and Corporate Express. Mark received a bachelor's and master's degree from MIT and a PhD from Brown University, all in geological sciences. I recently caught up with Mark at MetaStrategy headquarters in Washington, D.C., and our conversation covered world-class IT Principle 1, people, as we discussed the importance of setting up talented teams with strong leaders without creating single points of failure. Principle 3, project and portfolio management, as we discussed how financial management within IT helps build credibility with various business functions. Principle 4, IT and business partnerships, as we discussed how IT should build towards non-transactional relationships with business partners to influence collaboration. Principle 5, external partnerships, as we spoke about how he works with his peer CIOs who are the customers of Okta, along with a variety of other topics. This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and several other topics, all told with stories from leading CIOs from a variety of major corporations. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much. Settle, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thank you, Peter.
Great to see you. And congratulations on a terrific book, The Truth from the Trenches, A Practical Guide to the Art of IT Management. It was a great read, so congratulations on that.
I appreciate the feedback.
Mark, having gotten to know you over the years, you have, I'd say, an unusual amount of experience with big company as a chief information officer. And I can only imagine that part of the rationale, though I wanted to test this with you, in writing the book was codifying some of what you've learned from a multiplicity of experiences. What was your inspiration for taking some time out and thinking about sort of what are some of the important lessons that you would advise others who are walking in your wake to follow and maybe even some things not to?
So not only have I done this job in many different industries and different companies, but I have a pretty extensive network of contacts, peers, and that have done the job as well. You know, it's kind of shocking how many mistakes are made over and over again. I mean, it doesn't have anything to do with what the current technology of the day is, whether we're talking about cloud computing or ERP systems. It doesn't really have a whole lot to do with necessarily the size of the company or the extent of its international operations, et cetera, et cetera. The chronic failings of most IT organizations are almost systemic or endemic or whatever they do. They shoot themselves in the foot in so many common ways repeatedly. So yeah, part of this was really to kind of tell some stories and have an oral tradition of things to watch out for and to avoid, you know, trying to pass the lessons learned through more years than I want to count, you know, to the next generation of leaders. And as kind of part of that, there is an element of personal therapy in this as well. You know, I got on the couch and I debriefed myself about many of the frustrations. So I've committed many of these. This isn't me stepping back objectively and critiquing what others have done wrong. You know, part of this is a self confession as well of some of the mistakes that I've made. And some ways I think as a profession, you know, we hide behind a lot of jargon. I think if other functions in a company really were privy to some of the failings in process and leadership and talent management and accountability, that are pervasive in many organizations. I mean, they would be shocked because they think of IT as being a very sophisticated functional area.
One of the things I really liked at the outset, you talk about the dichotomy between leadership versus management. And actually, frankly, I also liked almost the paradox of the war analogy, the truth from the trenches, right, and then the art of IT management from a war analogy to the sublime. Can you talk a bit about your own thoughts of leadership versus management and the role that each plays?
So, obviously, there is a difference. I don't like the way it gets talked about in a lot of times in the press. I mean, leadership is almost talked about as a genetic capability that people have or don't have. You know, you can be a good manager, but only a few are
born leaders
that are going to stand out. And it's almost like you leave management behind. If you're the leader, you come down from the mountain with the tablets and have the vision, and people cluster around you, and you know, there are feats of heroism that occur because you know you're at the head of the army. But leaders usually start as good managers. You know, they've come up through the ranks and they've become very reliable in terms of being able to produce results, stick to budgets, gain the respect of their subordinates, etc. But leaders tend to go the extra mile or do things differently. One of the key differentiators is the way they use their discretionary time. So they put in place practices and processes for other people to be productive and don't become the single-threaded point of failure in an organization that everything has to flow through. I think that's a big differentiator. You know, the other is, how do I build the competency or the fabric of the organization to weather crises in the future or prepare for broader initiatives in the way I use my discretionary time? Am I bringing in perspectives from outside the organization? Am I building relationships with parts of the corporation that have been kind of overlooked or maybe underserviced in the past? There's a gravitational attraction in every IT organization for their leaders to spend infinite amount of time sitting in their own conference rooms, looking at PowerPoint presentations by their own staff, effectively providing quality control, you know, on activities that they personally performed earlier in their careers. And if you're not careful, you can really spend 98% of your time doing that. And the people in the leadership roles are uniquely positioned in terms of where they sit in the hierarchy and their titles to reach out and really expose the whole organization to perspectives and technologies and thoughts and customer relationships that nobody else can do. I mean, really, you have that title, and ultimately people just don't exercise that title. And so those are some of the marks of real leadership, is kind of going beyond just worrying about the internal day-to-day function of the organization and really thinking about how you use your discretionary time.
Yeah, and you also lament, actually, that you begin the book by talking about financial management of IT, when the good stuff, the real value, is eventually getting to innovation, a topic you cover in some depth later in the book. And I'd love to understand, if you wouldn't mind taking a moment to talk about the rationale in beginning with financial management, the sanctity of that as a foundational item that CIOs need to get right in order to kind of earn the possibility of getting more involved and maybe even driving innovation.
Financial competence and management, it's basically a credibility maker or a credibility killer in anybody who is, say joining an organization for the first time. So whether you're joining as a CIO or the VP of infrastructure or the senior director of data center operations, really you kind of have a one-dimensional perspective on life, and it's all around technical capabilities and technical metrics, etc., and the financial aspects of the way the world works seem to be kind of secondary in importance, or something we kind of get around to in the third conversation or the fourth conversation. One of the things I talk about in the book is business people don't want to get lectured by IT folks about the difficulties of running an IT organization or the financial inner workings, but they do pick up on whether you know how to run your business. And what I mean by that, you know, if you can refer to benchmarking studies or metrics that you use to measure your own internal efficiency, if you can speak knowledgeably about some of the vendor negotiations you've had and how you've traded off terms and conditions or pricing to get the best deal for the company, and maybe you've done that over a multi-year time frame instead of just worrying about the cost for the next renewal. Business people will never remember the particulars of that conversation, but they will walk away with the impression, this guy or this woman, they know their stuff. Like, they've been there, they've done this, they're asking all the right questions. I don't need to get into their business and start challenging them cost category by cost category. Why did we spend this much? Why did we go there, et cetera, et cetera? I think too many people get into a tutorial mode and they think, if I could just educate the business execs about how complex this this business is, running IT, the vendors I have to work with, the challenges of keeping these old systems up and running, then they'll really understand why it costs so much. They'll never understand why it costs so much. You know, they're not inclined to understand why it costs so much. They just want to get an understanding that you're not just sitting there taking the bills from the vendors, adding more staff, just incurring costs without a real sense of perspective. And so if you can establish that credibility to start with, many other initiatives and proposals that you'll have will just fall on deaf ears, because it'll just sound like you're off there on your own hobby shop, just spending the corporate resources to amuse yourself and the other guys in IT.
Yeah, and another credibility is based on relationship building, mm-hmm. a topic you talk about. You know, the stereotypical CIO, fair or unfair, is somebody who has great technical acumen, but is more introverted, perhaps, than, you know, a marketing executive or a human resources executive or maybe even an operations or finance executive. And you point out that that's to the IT executive's detriment if he or she is not building relationships. And you talk about inside as well as outside of IT. Can you lend some perspectives on that? It would seem in some ways that the technical aspects of the job should be the ones that are sacrosanct, but at the same time, many brilliant technologist has been fired for not doing the important work of building relationships with one's colleagues.
Yep. So there's really two dimensions where I think of a relationship with a business executive. So one is a social dimension. You know, simple things, knowledge of somebody's home address, you know, or where their kids go to school, what colleges they attended, what their favorite baseball team is, can go a long way towards lubricating situations that may be more contentious in nature downstream. It's just a funny thing about human nature. You know, I've been in many briefings with customers in some of the organizations I've worked with where we've sold services. And if you have dinner with a customer the night before, you have a whole different interaction experience when you meet with them the next day in a conference room. IT people in many cases don't put much of a premium or a focus on that, but you know, the social dimension is an important thing to have in the bank, and really it's not a hard thing to do. Most people broadcast their out-of-work interests pretty openly, so it's kind of an easy thing to pick up on. It just takes a little extra effort. The other way you can see that manifested is all too often IT people have a transactional relationship with their fellow executives. So they only really show up in the CFO's office or in the CMO's office if they have a specific topic to discuss or a specific transaction that needs to be adjudicated in some fashion or another. Whereas when you watch individuals in other roles, from sales in some cases, or maybe customer support, they just pop into each other's offices and you know, kind of socialize a little bit, which in some ways I think IT people would say, well, I would never want anybody just popping into my office and wasting my time, so I think it would be presumptuous for me to just pop into somebody else's office. But they don't realize that those you know, non-business transactional conversations are just building up the bank account of goodwill to be drained at some future point in time when they do need something from the other individual. So social is important. But that's not to the exclusion of the business relationship that you're going to have with a fellow executive. And so one of the points I make in the book is a healthy interest in the business is one of the most important traits of a successful IT executive. Just being curious about how does this work? Let me go to your quarterly business review and understand why we're not getting traction in the Southeast U.S. with this particular product. Or in the marketing organization, well, how did we misdesign that marketing campaign? Why did it only work for this kind of a demographic within our existing customer base, et cetera? In my personal experience, most of those other functions would welcome the participation or attendance by people from IT to learn more about the business, but they've just always presumed that the IT leadership is too busy, too preoccupied, has higher priority things to do. So you kind of have to invite yourself in. And even if you say to yourself, well, I know nothing about what they do over there in marketing, so I really would, it'd be a burden. I'd be wasting their time. You still get the gold star for effort. Like, you know, you sat there and you learned. So it, you know, ultimately becomes kind of a win-win proposition. So you have to invest that time. I think one of the other comments in the book is you should never pass up an invitation from a business exec to participate in a meeting, go on a business trip, you know, attend a dinner or a lunch with people outside the function, because that's how you're going to learn the most about how the business really works.
Mm-hmm. That dovetails nicely to another topic that I found very interesting. Chapter 6 is called Decoding Demand Signals from the Business. Especially, I mean, IT has one of the most complex purviews out there, because I often like to say,
the marketing executive has a strategy that is externally focused, based, you know, focused on potential and existing customers. An HR executive has a strategy that is internally focused on the employees of the company.
Right.
And even in great companies, they may not be able to quote from each other's strategic plans because of the different vectors associated with each of them. But an IT leader needs to breathe life into both of those plans and everyone in between. So whether external or internal, there are going to be profound IT components to every plan across the organization. So it behooves the IT leader and his or her team to get into the knitting of each of these organizations. I'd be curious, you've already begun to talk about this, but I'd be curious about the methods that you have used to get further up into the conversation as to when, you know, demand is being created as opposed to when it is absolutely complete and an order is placed. What are some of the things you've done to successfully do that?
In a lot of IT organizations, if it's not a trouble ticket or a project request, you know, it's not a source of demand to me. You know, we can sit in conference rooms and you can speculate about wouldn't the world be nicer, but if you can't codify that as a business case for a project or submit it as a trouble ticket, I can't deal with your interest or your speculation. I have been fortunate in a couple of circumstances to actually take a small tiger team into a functional area and go a mile in their shoes, sit a mile in their shoes. Like, just take maybe a two-week period and take a team, a multi-skilled team, and sit desk side with the people in your supply chain function or your order management function or your marketing function. Understand how they're really using the tools they have today, you know, what some of the more practical challenges are. So that's a certain kind of a demand, right? That's sort of the way we do business today. Are there better ways of doing it? Are we really using the tools that you've been provided in the past? Inevitably, you'll always discover that wow, they just need more training in what they already have. Like, we've given them a lot of great stuff, and they're just skimming the surface and using what they have today. So you always kind of discover that. I think another discovery that I've seen happen through those kinds of activities is that your normal liaison people that I talk about as super users, now typically there are one or two people in each functional area that are the IT liaison person, right? And they typically know more about the functions, about the systems being used in that function than anybody else. Sometimes they are disgruntled former IT people that went native and stayed in the functional area, et cetera. Which is not always good, because sometimes they have a bone to pick with their former colleagues in IT, and they want to make sure their former colleagues understand in the pecking order who's in charge, which can lead to some difficult situations. But my point being is they serve almost like the necking point in the hourglass. So there can be lots of needs within the organization, which they individually prioritize and really reflect their level of sophistication. So a classic example would be, you know, 50% of the people in order management might have some kind of a 17-step clicking process to get an order completed. They may be able to do that in their sleep and not think of that as particularly challenging, but if you could reduce the 17-click process down to a 3-click process, that would be revolutionary to 50% of the people in the function. But that would be unlikely to show up, you know, on the to-do list of the super user. The super user might remember the invoice that comes in from the French-based company that has to be divided into four time zones to be paid and happens twice a year and want some special customization to be able to support a fairly arcane and a kind of exceptional process. But I think where you were headed with the question was, you know, more strategically, what are the challenges of the function and how can we kind of get ahead of the game? I'd circle back and say that, again, comes from traveling with people, going to their reviews, really trying to... Well, it's really the walk the mile in the shoes of the more senior people to kind of get intuitively. One point I make in the book, I think you can learn more about the challenges and opportunities in a functional area sitting in an airline lounge with one of the executives than you can by going to 10 meetings back at headquarters. Because in many cases, if they have an alcoholic beverage, they'll sit there, they'll be pretty transparent about, you know, what's really the big opportunities they face, the big competitive pressures trying to deal with, et cetera.
Yeah. One of the things you also point out, you know, a leader is only as good as the people he or she has on the team, and talent management, therefore, rises to a high level of prominence in the book as well for very good reason. I was especially curious, as somebody who has worked in San Francisco and Silicon Valley for some time now, arguably the most difficult place to keep great talent because of the enormous number of opportunities that a talented person has at their disposal by virtue of being there. What are some of the practices that you have used in order to attract and retain great IT talent?
All good leaders are going to bring along some people that they've worked with in the past that are known quantities that have been successful in other organizations. I mean, that's kind of a given. But something I think maybe a lot of folks don't think about as intentionally, you almost have to become a politician and, you know, or a salesperson for your own organization. Some CIOs like to spend more time inside their own organizations and less time on the outside, but they're really doing themselves a disservice. So, you know, whether it's speaking at a local SIM meeting or an Ivana conference or an HMG strategy meeting or one of the Fortune conferences, those are all great opportunities to talk about the good things happening in your organization. The hosting meetings at your own physical shop is another way of getting people kind of to realize that you're part of a bigger community, et cetera. And your own people enjoy that opportunity. I mean, they think of themselves appropriately so as you know, kind of being leaders in the local IT community. So it's really important to create like a external perception about the importance of the work that's going on, the level of innovation that's happening in your company, the work-life balance that you're enforcing, et cetera. And then kind of people will come out of the woodwork when opportunities do arise. Or frankly, will approach you when there's not even a posted job, right? I mean, they'll let it be known that if there's going to be opportunities sometime in the future, they'd be very interested in exploring them. Mm-hmm. So I've had a lot of success with that.
That's great. You, one of the later chapters does, in fact, talk about innovation and the mandate for CIOs to get more involved in that. You highlight that innovation sort of takes a village to do it, an ecosystem that a CIO needs to build, a combination of vendors, customers, the IT team itself, of course,
yep.
One's colleagues. Can you talk a bit about the way in which you harness this ecosystem and as you are pulling ideas from each, the process you use to manage the ideas that bubble up as a result of these conversations and the internal work that IT is doing to ensure that progress is made from an innovation perspective?
You know, managing innovation is almost an oxymoron to some people. Like, how can it be innovative if we're managing it? But in the absence of it, you really become victimized by innovation. And what I mean by that is, there are many people going off in many different directions pursuing things that will never come to fruition, whether it's because cost considerations, organizational change considerations, et cetera. All very well intended as well, right? So, you know, a functional area, somebody may go off to a Salesforce.com conference. Well, that would be, they may go to an industry conference of some type and come back having fallen in love with a tool and ask somebody in IT to kick the tires, you know, see how this might work. That can happen. The vendors are always coming in with new ideas as well that they want you to try out, et cetera, et cetera. So there's this cluster or cloud of activity, again, all well-intended, but it's really a drain on the organization when the people running the shop, again, they know, we're never going to do this. I mean, or this might be extremely helpful for this one small group, but we would never go do this because if it were to be adopted on an enterprise basis, we'd have to displace six other, you know, existing tools, and it would cost us way too much money, et cetera, et cetera. And I really think it's an opportunity to plagiarize what your sales folks do, right? I mean, salespeople are very adept at not wasting their time because they're not going to make money unless they can get to a sale. And so what they do is they go from an initial lead to a qualified lead to a prospect to an opportunity to a deal, hopefully, at the end of the day. And there are different gating criteria to get from one of those buckets to the next. So the same thing should happen within IT when it comes to seriously looking at new technologies that could be used for the good of the corporation. And when properly managed, you can actually make that process transparent. You may have people, this is another interesting paradox. I've gone through laborious product evaluation processes and selection processes and then announced that we're going to go off, we bought a new tool and it'll be deployed. And there'll be three people in some part of the organization who'll raise their hand and say, oh yeah, I used that one job ago. I know everything about that. But we were totally unaware that they had any, that we had anybody in the organization that had even touched this thing. So if we'd done a better job being transparent, we could have leveraged their knowledge and probably, you know, learned more and maybe accelerated the process at the end of the day. Having hard criteria in terms of the gates so you don't waste a lot of organizational energy pursuing things that will ultimately go nowhere, and being as transparent as possible and letting the entire organization participate. When people talk about innovation labs, I always get a little bit nervous about innovation labs. Because it's sort of like we're going to go find, you know, 5% of the organization and let them have all the fun. They're going to get to wander around and try new things, etc. While everybody else is down in the, you know, the galley of the slave ship with the oars, you know, and you just keep rowing down there as hard as you possibly can. And the guys up on deck, they'll let you know if they see something kind of fun that you might benefit from in the future. And people won't always articulate that, but that cast kind of system, I mean, intuitively, people, that resonates with people very, very quickly. Like they've been given the lousy jobs. They're just going to, they're expendable long term. Their skills are obsolete. There's new things that are coming in. So that's another reason why the transparency of that process is extremely important, just from the overall morale of the organization. You know, the whole organization gets buy-in as well. One thing I've seen with some of the innovation labs, they can get pretty far downstream having screened and falling in love with some kind of a new tool. Then the practical reality of, well, let's implement this in our storage farm, or let's apply this to the commercial website as the new monitoring capability. And it's almost like starting the process all over from scratch as you explain the new capability to the operations staff. And, you know, you displace the old tool, and it's, you know, they haven't been brought along through the process. And even if intuitively or, you know, emotionally they're supportive, the adoption can spread out over time because it's just another... It's kind of pay me now, pay me later. You know, if you don't socialize it and get them involved up front, you're going to have to do that downstream, and you can cause a lot of bruised feelings in the process.
Exactly, yeah. You have been the CIO of a number of companies, as I mentioned at the outset, Oxy, Aero Electronics, Corporate Express, BMC Software, IHS, now Okta. In multiple of these companies, including your current one, the customer of your company is oftentimes the CIO in his or her team.
Yes.
We are doing this interview in Washington, despite the fact that you're based in the Bay Area because you're here visiting customers. There are a lot of CIOs who don't actually have customer touch points as clearly you do. And I'm curious, as someone who has worked in multiple organizations where technology was the business, as well as in those same companies where your peers were the customers,
right.
How do you think about the way in which IT adds value? And also, how do you think about leveraging those touch points with your peers as customers of the company as a means of developing and drawing in insights as to how the company, as well as IT, can be better?
It's interesting. In the companies I've worked for where we actually sold products or services to other IT organizations, I'll kind of reveal something here. So in many cases, the sales executives that would take me out to meet with customers, they would be very apologetic and almost deferential. Like, I know you're busy and I know you've got a lot to do, but if you could just go out and spend some time with these folks that are considering the use of our product or our service. So here's kind of maybe the unanticipated outcome of that. Almost inevitably, you would find customers using products in the way that we probably should have been using it ourselves internally. And I would go out on these visits and somebody would tell me, oh, we configured your tool this way and now it supports this process, and I look at this report once a month, and as the customer would go on and on about what they were doing with the product, I think, why don't I do this? Why aren't we doing this? So it was very educational in those kind of situations. In the ones where it's not a direct product or service, then I think you look more to your own internal IT operations, right? And it comes around to, how are you monitoring your systems? Or how do you optimize the use of your storage? Or how are you leveraging AWS? Which systems have you put on AWS? Which not? How are you making those trade-offs, et cetera? So there's a lot of knowledge. When I send people, I'm very supportive of having members of my team visit other companies. I think there's way too much reinventing of the wheel that goes on within IT shops. I kid about this in the book. If you were going to look at a tool for anything, classic approach would be to, well, let's get the top three contenders, let's set up a test environment, let's bring them all in, you know, and then we'll come up with some test cases and we'll run them all through. And nobody would say, should we pick up the phone and maybe call you? Company X, they're across the street. They've had this for like 2 years. Maybe they could. That's the last thing, because most IT people would love that idea about a project. So bottom line, there's just a lot of lessons learned if you leverage your network and build relationships with other companies. And so when I send people out on these little crusades, sometimes I kid and I tell them, think about yourself as a member of the One Idea Club. Just go over there. If you just come back with one idea, it's been a hugely productive use of everybody's time. You know, I'm not asking you to go over there and completely reinvent the way we do. storage utilization management. But like if they're doing one thing that you can come back here, you know, it's a win-win for everybody.
That's great. Yeah. Last question, Mark. I wanted to ask you, as you think about kind of trends that are rising in importance, which ones are the ones that you're most intrigued by? You know, as you're developing your own roadmaps for, say, the next couple of years, maybe several years out, and given the number of conferences you go to, and just generally the amount of thinking that you're doing around technology and how it's evolving, what are some that are rising in importance in your own mind?
One thing that really intrigues me is, you know, in the old days of business applications where you had mostly licensed software sitting on-prem, your core systems were typically updated on a quarterly basis, and there'd be a quarterly release and a pretty formal approval process. You know, you'd have your change approval board, your change control board that would say grace over, these are the changes we're going to put in the next time around. Even in the initial days of SaaS tools appearing, you know, the center of gravity was still on-prem, or the SaaS tools could be reconfigured on a more frequent basis or have configuration changes, but more fundamental changes in maybe the way integrations were adopted and data was exchanged among applications would still come under that more formal process. Now, in the greater IT industry, Agile and DevOps have become, they're the language of the kingdom, you know, lingua franca of IT these days. But I'm not sure people have really thought all the way back to how do we take some of that agility that we're trying to, that we have obtained in terms of commercial product development, you know, and SaaS services, and then migrate that back into the inner workings of large companies. Why are we still caught up in these like quarterly release cycles or bi-monthly release cycles, holding the business at bay? How do we get, you know, more changes, more innovation, more of what they need out faster to them? Now, sometimes they're the problem because they'll tell you, I can't deal with like every Monday some new little feature and function being added. Just package those all together and I'll train on that like once every quarter. I can barely keep up with that because there's too much change happening. But I think we kind of have to crack that nut kind of one way or another. Mm-hmm. We can't just kind of sit back and take the core systems that are driving the business functions and think about putting significant updates in every 3 months or 6 months. There has to be a better way of doing that in the future.
Yeah. Great insight. Well, Mark Settle, thank you so much for taking time with me today, sharing insights from your terrific book, Truth from the Trenches, A Practical Guide to the Art of IT Management. Great seeing you.
Thank you, Peter.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to Meta Strategies' five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy-setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.